question.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of interesting question. I've never met you before, so I don't really... Okay, so, I guess you guys are getting married. That's pretty exciting, right? I guess my question for you is, I've done some studying, okay, and a theme that emerges is that you're a programmer, right? And you're
good
kind
conclusion.
Of... Yeah, okay, you're correct.
Very perceptive. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. You're very deep into computers and the programming work that you do, and I wondered whether you thought that being married would detract from your programming.
No, I wouldn't be getting married if I thought that.
Okay.
Hey, we've been together for a while now and hasn't distracted him yet.
Yeah.
Yeah, but we were together the entire development of Quake 3.
Okay.
Didn't suffer too much.
Do you guys want something to drink?
So what's the date?
Technically, we're being married on the 1st. But
No. I mean, a date, like you guys would go out. What would be like a date that you guys would have?
Can't say. Don't really have much.
No, but I mean, would you guys go to a movie, or would you guys
walk
down to the cafeteria?
Like, lately we've actually been building some model rockets and going those off.
Oh, awesome. I did that too. Those were fun. With the parachutes and stuff?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, it's like I was doing an interview one time, and somebody, asked me about, my teenage years or whatever, and I mentioned, rockets and bombs and stuff like that, and I was thinking, that was kind of fun.
You missed
and
that.
And so it's like, of course, nowadays, you just go on the internet and go and say, I want one of these and one of these and one of these. Of course, nowadays, they've got rockets that we never had back when I was doing it, these high-power rockets with, 2,000 newton seconds of thrust.
What, you mean they go much higher?
They've got some pretty serious ones now.
What, different bells and whistles besides going higher?
Really high power.
Okay.
Yeah.
Lots of horsepower, though.
Yeah.
So to speak. Okay. Let me see. Wow. Well, that was pretty... I guess... Did you guys ever one-on-one deathmatch?
Yeah,
it's just... me all the time.
Yesterday we had... we were out at Apple, and Anna was playing one of the Apple guys. She was kicking his ass, I was in a meeting with some other people, and so they were playing for a while, and she was just laying on. How many games?
Four games.
A whole bunch. But
I think out of all four, he was only able to strike me twice.
Oh, wow. He had 5 points at the end of that.
Wasn't that you?
No, he had 5 at the beginning of that.
Okay.
I came in. But then, when I finished my meeting, they snuck me into that guy's room, and he sat me down, and I came back to a narrow victory over him.
Congratulations.
Yeah. I expected to hear her cursing from the other side of the building then.
Yeah, I let her win.
Because she still thought it was the other guy, just magically acquiring skills at the end of the game.
So wait, how old are you?
29.
So 29. So I know a lot of people in their 20s who are getting married, but it's kind of like there's been a lot of divorce in our society in the past and stuff like that. I wondered, why did you decide to get married?
This isn't a gaming interview.
It is. It's about
this is a personal thing. Okay, now I wouldn't have invited you guys.
Really? Is that right?
It'd be a personal thing.
Oh, you wouldn't have. Okay, because I'm just the way I studied for this was I read a lot of interviews and I said I don't know very much, about John Carmack, the way the problem solving is.
Talking about my personal life.
Okay. Okay. We'll skip all that then. I'm sorry about that. Okay. I guess. I did have one. Let me try this one, and you tell me whether this is okay. I read the early interview where you said you were into bombs and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You were a miscreant kid.
Yeah, I was. In a lot of ways, I look back, and I was an arrogant little jerk when I was a teenager.
You said that.
And
but it turned out pretty good for society, right?
Yeah, and I think that. No, generally a whole lot of things matured over the years where I look back and it's like I don't think that highly of myself when I was a teenager. Yeah, I was really smart. I was still, I was already programming computers in a lot of ways, but I was just completely amoral.
But so what would you do to raise a kid, or if you were giving advice to people who had kids like you in their school who are out of control?
Well, I was pretty frustrated about the fact that there was, in my case, I knew exactly what I wanted to be doing. I wanted to be programming.
Even at your teen years, your young teen.
Yeah, even when I was 12, I knew that that's what I wanted to be doing. And I had these clear ideas of what I wanted to get. And, well, yeah, it's true. You can't just say, the world owes me whatever whatever I want to get.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is a specific case that, like, my parents just never really understood that, so I never got the computers that I wanted until... I held that against my mother for, like, a decade, but we're all past that now.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, but it was like being able to get turned on about what you were into and having access to that.
It was just frustrating because I clearly knew exactly what I wanted to be doing, and it was just, you know, it wasn't available there, and it was always, no, you need to be going and, like, if you want to do computers, you need to go to MIT or something, and then you need to go work at a corporation.
Yeah, be an engineer.
And, yeah. And, you know, follow the path. And, yeah, I think my brother followed a more conventional path. Mm. You know, he went and got a degree, and he's a stockbroker and all that, and that was, like, pretty much what my parents, like, expect, or my mother at least, like, expected you're supposed to do. You know, he's doing okay for himself, but, you know, I dropped out of college and started the other stuff and then formed my own company, and, you know, I mean, there's nothing like
it's a few... kind of happy now, right?
Yeah, there's nothing like a few Ferraris to, you know, like, rub your parents' face in it.
Or make them happy.
Yeah, we're familiar with that.
I mean, I think that my values and what I would think about raising children is that if you have an exceptionally bright children, the right thing is to try to help them to bloom and get, you know, those creative juices flowing. But at the same time, you want to be able to give them proper guidance and be able to give them, way to appreciate the fact that things don't come easy in life and have them earn certain things versus not giving them such a strict area where they don't have the tools available so that they can be creative, but still be able to let them know that you earn things. You don't get a chance.
So it's a tough thing because, like, I know, you know, even at the time when I was, like, hating her guts, I mean, I knew my mother was thinking for my best interest, you know. I mean, I could tell it
in her way what she thought were your best
interests. She thought that this was, you know, this was the only right way, and you're going to throw your life away if you do anything else.
There's always a lot of compromise. I mean, you can't be straight just in one way, both the parents and the kids just, you know, not yielding either way. I mean, we have kids have learned from mistakes that our parents have made.
Okay. Yeah. Never, otherwise, well, we'd be perfect by now if all of us got all the generations of
history. A lot of parents nowadays, and even before, they don't do the what I would consider the smart things to do when that is learned from their parents' mistakes. They, a lot of times in the olden days, they think, my parents raised me like this, and this is the way it's supposed to be.
That's right.
They didn't think that there's any other way of...
change circumstances or context.
Versus nowadays, we have the more freedom because before, there was more societal plague almost, where if you did not do what society told you was right, then you'd end up becoming this big, you know, plague upon society, and everybody would be, you know, shunning you. Versus nowadays, we have the freedom to be able to think for ourselves and say, you know, well, we think that this is a better way.
Right.
It's right or not, but we're willing to give it a try. But I mean, you look at the Asian tradition, and you look at the older parents, and their parenting style is pretty much, it's a cookie cutter type of parenting. My parents did it this way, and I'm going to do it this way, and so on and so on. And they don't, you know, try to think about it. I really didn't like that about my parents.
Yeah.
You know.
It's conceivable that today, I mean, in our culture that places such a high value on individuality and on excelling as an individual, that parents might say, gosh, I hope my child becomes as successful as John Carmack, or, you know, as much as an individual, because you earned your success then. That's one thing you can say, right? Your parents didn't hand you.
I can talk about, you know, I find, like, everything's fine with my mother at this point in my life and everything. We can talk about all things like that and look back. I can say, all right, she recognizes that she was kind of wrong about all that, but I'm like, okay, what good does that do? She's not raising another child or anything. You know?
But she gave you great genes, right?
Yeah.
At least that.
Yeah, definitely. There's some good genetic material for my parents in there.
Okay. I guess, and then I was thinking, have you ever had any thoughts, like, you have some money, right? I mean, I know you have great cars, and you have a nice leather coat and all that stuff.
I have sufficient money that I don't need to work anymore.
That's great.
I don't have to.
Yeah. You could spend all your time researching obscure graphics and stuff. But
and that's a nice freedom.
He can leave the house and I can bring home the bacon.
Yeah, he can read and program and.
No, it's a nice freedom. The thing that the money gives you like that is freedom from anybody having the ability to have any leverage over you.
As long
as you've got the money to take care of yourself and you aren't wrapped up in having more and more money.
That's right.
I mean, there are a lot of people, even though they have a lot of money, they can still be manipulated by, you know, the carrot of having more money.
Right.
Yeah, my in my position, I have basically everything that I want. I've got enough money to take care of myself forever. So, you know, it just, you know, nobody, not Microsoft, not any company, can actually have any leverage at all on me because they just have no, you know, there's nothing that they can do.
So is there something where you've thought of you, the way that you could use your money to have leverage in other situations? I mean, in terms of...
I try not to think about that much because I try not to be too much proactive in terms of trying to make other things happen. I mean, I like to work directly on the technical aspects of things. And while, yeah, there probably are some things that I could do if I wanted to, like, leverage the money in different ways, but I'm much more interested in trying to actually, you know, do things and accomplish things directly. And that's one reason why. I mean, I'm not a good manager. I mean, I'm not, you know, I'm not really a good company leader in various ways because I'm an engineer. I mean, I want to, like, fix things directly. I don't want to, like, set the circumstances up such that they become fixed, even though I recognize in many cases for larger projects that's what needs to be done.
Yeah.
But it's just not something I'm uniquely suited for. I mean, I have, you know, a specific area that I'm very, very good at, and I happen to enjoy it a whole lot. So I don't feel a whole lot of, you know, a desire or pressure to go out and, like, you know, try and exploit other aspects of it. And it's like, yeah, I do kind of have a pile of money sitting around, but, you know, I'm happy with
you're uniquely focused. That's amazing.
There's a lot of companies, they fall into the pitfall where they have these really amazingly intelligent people that are great engineers, and their company starts growing and growing and growing, and rather than starting to focus more on the technical aspects, their talents are kind of wasted because they're not managers, but they're forced into management.
Because of their experience.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I know some engineering companies in particular that I work with that I feel really bad for because, like, the founders that were incredible engineers, you know, are now, like, directors of their departments, and then they've got people that are nowhere near as good as they originally were actually doing the work, and it's caused some, you know, some significant companies
slow down.
And that's, you know, that's what I hope never really happens to me. I mean, I want to stay in the trenches working on things all the time because, well, there is some benefit to sitting back and, like, you know, reading and researching and doing things and getting some broader scope on it. You know, if you're divorced from the kind of low-level nuts and bolts of things, like, you know, how this actually applies to the real world, you know, then you're just like an academic, and there's these huge disconnects between what an academic can do and what somebody in production can do. And I mean, over the last two projects, my time has basically been split. I would have like 3 months of pure research, basically, just tooling
around
in a
Florida hotel room or something,
in different things. And I mean, I'm in that phase right now, playing around with different stuff, and then it's like 16 months of work on the project. And it would be nice if I could shift that a little bit more
towards the research end.
Yeah, but I mean, I would never want to do even a majority of research because the whole point of research, in my mind, is you figure out a new way to do something, but then you actually want to go do something with it, not just like have the knowledge that it's possible to do something with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. Well, I mean, I guess you are a personality. Your focus is astonishing, and of course, it's yielded these incredible results. Bob has them with him, but this time and place, you're uniquely suited to this time and place. I mean,
focus,
the software explosion.
Focus is extremely useful. I mean, in so many ways. But I mean, as far as like this specific time and place, I do think software is an almost uniquely wonderful medium. But if it wasn't here, I'd be some other type of engineer. You know, most likely engineer. Failing that, some kind of scientist or something.
Yeah,
I mean, I could have just a fine time working in, you know, any kind of electronics or mechanical engineering or anything else. But software is so wonderful in that, you know, like, the people that are setting up for a physics experiment or something, you spend a year of preparation time, you know, tooling around doing things, and then something happens.
You fire a laser wand.
Yeah, and then you spend a year analyzing.
Yeah.
You know, while with software, you can just say, you can have an epiphany of an idea, and then you can just sit down and hash it out. You can just make it happen right there. It's the most malleable, like, you know, media to be working in for any kind of intellectual pursuit. And that's, you know, I do feel fortunate that that I'm around in the time when all this is going on.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't remember again, like, when I was, you know, when I was a lot younger and as a teenager, not having the computer that I wanted, I was like, I had this frustration, it's like, I'm missing it, you know, it's like, I should be writing these games and stuff there, like, I should be doing this, you know, the early Apple II games, and it's like, I was just genuinely frustrated that I felt like I was missing the golden opportunity. And of course, you know, I didn't know that, you know, I was just going to come in on a later golden opportunity.
Yeah, yeah.
And
no, that's
in fact,
right.
It was, you read the book, Hack Packers by Stephen Lane.
Yeah, it's a great book.
Yeah, I mean, I was reading that when I was a teenager. I'm like reading the third section on the game, and it's like, God damn it, I should be here. And, but then, like, five, 10 years later, you know, I actually thought back about it. And it's like, you know, if there was a fourth chapter in that book, a fourth section, I probably would have been in there.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was just interesting to see that come out where, you know, I honestly thought that I was, like, missing my shot when I was a lot younger, that there was this golden age of, like, you know, the early development on PCs, and I was really frustrated that I wasn't there.
Do you think that it's just the very act of programming and the very thing of making your ideas into code that's inspiring for you, or were there actual games that you can name that you were playing on the Apple II and the PC early on that were...
I can name all of the games that I really liked at the time.
Yeah.
I mean, it's programming in the abstract sense really is what I enjoy. I mean, I do enjoy, like, lots of different areas of it.
Yeah.
Well, in the gaming industry, there are a lot of people that are specifically in it because they love games and they love, like, specific games and they want to create things. But, you know, my love for programming is a more abstract thing where, I mean, I really could take... I mean, I'm taking a great deal of enjoyment right now writing device drivers for Linux. And, you know, I could also be having a good time writing a database manager or something because there's interesting problems. And, you know, the challenge... There are some things that are inherently more rewarding than others. I mean, graphics and games are probably, you know, the most generally rewarding area of programming.
How so?
Because you get really nice feedback. Like, when you write a graphics algorithm, it draws a picture for you. And while data can be rewarding in its own way when you see, a table of the right things coming up, but in general, the human species is wired to respond much more strongly to visual things and things that have to be interpreted from symbols.
Yep.
So there's something fundamental there why it's a neat thing, but we do get to work on a whole lot of other areas and stuff. I enjoy all aspects of it, but games have always just been one place where there's challenging things there, and, you know, it's interesting and it has its own reward at the end aside from the problem itself.
Okay.
But yeah, the early games that, it's interesting, early on I was just really into the RPG games, the Ultimas and Wizardries and all those things.
Yeah.
And some of the very early games that I wrote for the Apple II were basically like Ultima rip-offs on there for my first couple... My first couple published games for Apple II things were basically little Ultima rip-offs on that, but I also loved all of the straight arcade games,
and
certainly all the classic games. And
I mean, because in some ways, I guess Dungeons and Dragons is a program that you put yourself into, and you use words and dice and tables.
It's a similar
and
thing about being able to create things completely from scratch. You know, a media where you don't have inbuilt limitations on it,
but you make a structure to tell stories within, right? Which is what Quake engine is. It's,
I mean, we set out. In fact, the original story Quake was supposed to be not an RPG exactly, but a fantasy game. The very first Quake, but it completely diverged from that just because of Quake's sorted development process. But since then we've been much more honest with our goals at the beginning on what we're doing, and they've been very different games, but I've been happy with the results.
Okay.
So it's unlikely that we'd ever go in and do a fantasy role-playing game type thing.
Well, I heard you cut back on your dungeon, your personal dungeon mastering.
Well, we
Dungeons
had
and Dragons.
Up until through Wolfenstein, we basically played, the entire company played every weekend. It tailed off basically in June. We had actually ran a couple games last year, just kind of for fun. But it takes so much time to do that.
A lot of preparation.
And to do a good job, you spend like a day playing and a day preparing, and there's just no way I can sacrifice 20% of my hours for anything. And that runs into a few things on there where, I mean, I'm good at some of these other things, but I can look at things and it's like I'm uniquely talented at a certain area of things, and a lot of times I look at it, it's like, well, I can have a good time with this, or I can have a good time with this.
Yeah.
I happen to have more impact when I have a good time on this particular thing.
So this focus, you might call that inspiration, right? Like you're inspired one day, you've got an idea how you can improve an algorithm or something, right? How often do those epiphanies come to you?
Well, so much of it, I mean, that is one thing where I think a lot of people put too much emphasis on the epiphanies. I mean, epiphanies are there. You do get them where you see it, you see clearly into something and all that. But it really is true that most great works aren't a result of epiphanies. They're a result of just, like, lots of hard labor. And And that is a trap that a lot of people fall into, where you look at that and you think that the epiphany is the important thing. And sometimes it is, but in 95% of the cases, it's a matter of just, like, you know, smooth, calm integration of everything that you know, and just, it's not the one brilliant decision, it's the 500 smart decisions that really make things good. And it's more a matter of, like, being able to, like, keep making smart decisions. I mean, making one brilliant decision and then, like, a whole bunch of mediocre ones isn't as good as making a whole bunch of, generally smart decisions throughout the whole process. And there's so many of them that have to be made. And it's, even at the end of it, like on Quake 3, I mean, I had a to-do list that had, like, over 1,000 potential things that could be improved on in there. So it's a matter of just going through and knowing all of these things that, you know, that could be done, and then it's a matter of prioritizing and deciding what kind of are the sweet spots of, like, this amount of effort will get this, you know, batch of things done, it'll have these side effects, or it would take all day to do this thing and probably destabilize something else, and I'm not going to do it. So there, I mean, I definitely enjoy the epiphanies when they come, when I've got, when I can be working on something and just realize that there's a much better way of doing it. And that's very rewarding, but, I mean, I can't say that those happen every day.
Sure.
And to a lesser degree, there's probably some insight that I can actually, you know, often come home and tell Anna, it's like, I figured something new out today, and that happens fairly often.
Yeah.
And that's good when I can actually, you know, in many ways, figuring something out like that will bring a smile to my face for, like, you know, an entire day in some cases.
It's just kind of having funny because he's, like, really serious coding, and all of a sudden he has this ear-to-ear grin.
You're kind of like a wizard, right? I mean, you're in a tower, and then you're, like, over your potions or anything, and all of a sudden, you know, boom, and, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, I have to think of myself more as a troll, just like, go away, sir. Now, dark room.
Okay, so you are hands down, the world's foremost gaming engineer, right? And so within that world, or at least one of them, and so within that world, do you believe that there's enough range of path and depth within that to keep you intrigued for years to come? I mean, in terms of keeping the graphics going and then the different physics and everything?
There's a lot of different stuff. I mean, right now I am spending, I'm spending more of my time in this kind of lull break time working on some things in Linux in some different aspects. It's kind of fun.
Linux intrigues you as an OS and gets it to work and things?
There's some interesting things. And one of the things that I've done is I've written two 3D drivers for Linux, or done a good chunk of the coding on them, and that's useful for me as a developer because, I mean, I certainly do the high-level stuff, I do the API-level programming, but it's also good to go ahead and, like, take it underneath that and do some implementation-level stuff on the device driver down to programming the hardware, because it gives me more scope to look at things from the entire process. And, you know, there are a lot of programmers that, you know, only know things from the top and don't realize why things sometimes are the way they are because they're structured that's invisible to them. And one of the other things that I'm kind of considering doing, kind of along those same lines, if I'd like to know things very clearly from the highest to the lowest level, I'm considering spending some time implementing, like, my own network stack for things just as a research learning experience. And I've also got some experiments that I want to try with finding out how much, like, overhead the operating system actually does impose in the routing time and, like, queuing things down to a serial driver level from a packet driver level. And there's some information that I'd like to be able to get from, you know, below the layers that you're normally communicating to.
Is that just in Linux or in Windows and Mac
as well?
Well,
the thing there is that it's just easier to do under Linux because you've got the ability to hook anything you want out. And while Linux is clearly not ready for, like, replacing Windows on people's desktops, you know, it's just not. But there is something really, truly, fundamentally cool there in the aspect that, I mean, the whole way I got into this, that I got started on this, that I spend a moderate amount of time on right now, is there was somebody had written the base of the Linux driver of the Matrox cards, and I had been reading about it for a while, and that they had it working barely with Quake 3. So I finally got around, like, in downloading it and checking it out and everything, and I was pretty impressed by how well it worked. It was slow, but it was pretty nearly feature complete in terms of it was good quality implementation. But there was, like, this really obvious bug with the way textures were swapping, where the textures were swapping most recently instead of least recently, so it splash on screen a little bit.
I like that. It kind of looks like it's fractalizing something.
Yeah, it looks like where you've got a texture and like parts of it would be constantly changing to another texture.
I think that should be a feature.
But I knew exactly what it was doing. So it's like, okay, this has the source code available. So I figured out how to download it, get access to the CVS repository and all that, worked my way through the code, found the bug, and fixed it. And, you know, that's just really pretty fundamentally neat, because the corollary of that was that Apple had exactly that same bug in their driver for a while. So, I mean, here we had, you know, a case of the same bug appearing in two drivers, but the Linux one, I was able to just go in and fix it. And while there's certainly a lot of barriers to entry on a lot of levels on that, the ability fundamentally to know that if you're working on this system that's all open source, and if anything annoys you enough, you can spend the time and just go fix it yourself. You know, you don't have to wait for anyone. You don't have to, like, ask nicely for it and, you know, wait for a patch and all that. You know, it's not usually cost-effective time-wise to go do it, but if something's really pissing you off, you just go find the code and fix it, and that's really cool.
And that's exactly your kind of attitude in terms of hands-on.
Yeah.
You don't wait for Microsoft to issue an update. You do it yourself.
Right. And so that's why, you know, if I was to be doing some, like, networking research or whatever, it would be something where you could do it in Linux, and you could just, if you want to, you could go in and gut parts of the operating system and say, okay, I'm just going to grossly cut all of this out right now because I want to be doing something experimentally. There's a lot of freedom there. And I do think over the course of the next couple years, a lot of usability stuff will be straightened out. And there's, you know, there's a lot of economic trends that make it relevant where, you know, you start looking at PCs costing down under $500 and everything, and looking at it as a $90 Windows license in there. And if people are just using it for the basic stuff, I think there probably will be a fairly significant adoption of free operating systems for that type of stuff. But, you know, it's not... There's a lot of zealots in the Linux space that, you know, that just don't really have rationality in their viewpoints there. But there is actually a lot... There is some truth behind the hype on actually how good it is.
So, okay, here's another tack. You are very focused and you drive yourself. Have you ever thought of, at this point in your life, besides Anna, taking on a boss to help you learn, right? I mean, to help you learn new skills, to get someone else to focus your efforts so that you would learn different things?
For the record, I'm not his boss and he's not mine.
Okay. Okay.
I mean, there is some benefit I can see to to having management on some things. We brought Graham on at the end of Quake 3 to kind of help manage a bunch of aspects of the things. It didn't wind up having any real impact on the way I was doing things, because Graham's not quite fiercely organized enough to, like, you know, stay on top of everything like that. It turns out that my personal organization is greater than what most managers could wind up imposing on me. Although I'm aware of the limits of my personal organizational skills, where I have this, you know, this list of 1,000 things, and every once in a while I go through and start to, you know, bubble sorting things up towards the top of, you know, of that. But I do in my mind think, you know, it would be great if somebody was here whose primary job was to just make sure that they knew and understand all of those, because everybody has their own, you know, kind of weaknesses in organizational skill where, you know, you don't recognize yourself doing it, but if there's something that you, like, don't want to deal with, you know, it just bubbles down, and I recognize the benefit of having somebody that's kind of a conscience for you, you know, in the workload stuff. And in fact, you know, that's kind of one of the things where I recently put out kind of the call for somebody to, like, be doing some conformance testing on the OpenGL aspects of things, specifically on the Linux driver stuff, because, you know, while I'm doing a reasonable amount of coding on that, and I'm trying to be reasonably conscientious about it, but I know that, like, I'm directing things in certain ways to just, like, meet my goals, and while I've got the ideal desire to be, you know, to do a perfect implementation, I just recognize that, you know, in my limited time, I wind up directing myself not necessarily in best coverage, and sometimes it is good to have somebody else that, you know, that can sit back and kind of be a conscience for your, you know, for your efforts.
Yeah.
But it's all still kind of a theoretical issue for me. I believe there's benefit for that, but I've yet to actually see it demonstrated in my direct presence.
Okay, less about organization then, but then think about a boss as a teacher. Is there there anyone that you think you could learn, that you feel you might learn from, or a situation in which you could imagine yourself to?
I actually learn things from almost everyone that, and this is one of the major differences from, like, me as a teenager versus me now. My views as a teenager were that I am smarter than, like, all of these people around me, therefore I will completely ignore everything that anyone has to say. I went through, like, you know, a couple semesters of college classes and stuff, and I look back on it now, it's just, I was not treating things in the right way, and it's like, well, yeah, I mean, maybe I was smarter than the professor in the class or whatever. It didn't mean that I didn't have things that I could learn from them, and the way I go about things now is practically everyone that I wind up working with on a programming level, I learn something from. I mean, like, you know, I can look at the time that I spent with Brian Hook. I mean, I learned some better C coding standards and, like, strong use of struct and const through things that I wouldn't normally do, that I would just normally not bother with. And that's been, like, a positive thing that I've improved on from there. Like, working with Graham, I'm seeing him put things together very quickly from, like, the Java libraries on things that I would have rolled from scratch and taken longer to do. So, you know, it doesn't take someone that's necessarily a better developer or programmer to have things that you can learn from, and that's like a really important lesson that I've kind of pulled in my life over the last decade, that there's knowledge waiting to be gained just all around you and just about everything. There's benefits to putting yourself in an information-rich environment, like at a university or something, if you've got the right attitude.
Yep.
You know, if you're looking for things to, if you're looking for anything to be learned from anywhere you can get it, rather than, like, only looking for, you know, maybe, like, the one mother load where you've got everything together. You know, you have to glean things. You know, you have to be able to, like, grab things from anywhere that you can get it. And, I mean, there were some, some interesting things, like, during the development of Quake, when we hired Michael Abrash, I was, you know, really, really psyched about that, because I learned, like, a lot of my early PC programming skills for assembly language and graphics chips from his articles and everything, in Dr. Dobbs and everything. So that was really great to bring him on, and I did pick up some further things from him and everything, but it was interesting where, you know, he was almost uncomfortable for a while where, you know, he got fairly deferential on the programming side to me about things, because I was still, you know, Michael knew an immense amount of stuff in various ways, but, you know, I've still been, like, on this very quick learning curve and things, and, almost all the programmers that I've worked with, I've learned things from one way or the other.
Okay, let me ask you this then. You mentioned gleaning things from the world around you. Non-technical sources, books and movies. Recent?
My favorite book in recent years is definitely A Deepness in the Sky by Bernard Vinn.
Yeah.